it is different. The market here is different. The industry is different. And one of these things is that, well, you cannot just come here with a lot of cash and expect that everything will be fine, right? This is one thing. So what are some other differences that you have noticed throughout your work here in Japan?
Wow, how long do we have? Okay, so the...
Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so for today's episode, this is the first of two conversations that I've had recently with Maya Matsuoka of the Japan Expert Insights podcast and YouTube channel. They're a consulting firm specializing in Japanese business culture, cross-cultural management, leadership, customer experience, and business strategy in Japan. And their podcast and YouTube channel is one of my personal favorites. So I'm a bit of a fanboy, was very flattered to be on. And our interview is mainly on the topic of real estate property investment in Japan. How we came to do what we do and set up NTI in the first place, what makes Japan a bit more challenging than other markets worldwide, and also what makes it attractive. Why the Japanese are often reluctant to work with foreigners, how is the real estate market here different or counterintuitive, at least to what buyers are used to overseas. The rental market tenancy laws, how those work here, what Japanese tenants are like generally, how market fundamentals like purchase price and growth or capital gains work here, what the general business environment is like. We then dived into more granular stuff like various asset classes, what we recommend to our clients and why, and how Japan's population trends and the investor's profile might affect the choice of asset classes. What's included and sometimes not included in online property listings, what questions to ask, what Japanese realtors do and don't do, and of course where we come in and that gap as well as other gaps that we fill. We also talk location selection, Hokkaido specifically, and other snow country property complications. And then we went on a bit of a segue and spoke a little bit about foreigner hub cities, cities that tend to attract more foreigners, which then led us to get completely sidetracked and speak about the effect of the current anti-foreigner sentiment, the policies on the property market and on foreign ownership, visa policies and so forth. And finally, we talked a bit about the purchase process itself. What happens when? What's common overseas that isn't common here? What level of negotiation is acceptable and not acceptable and so forth? So I know I say this a lot, but this one really is a deep dive on all things related to real estate property investment here in Japan. Great place to start if you're just looking into this market for the very first time, but also definitely worth a listen if you're already active here or just about to pull the trigger on your first deal. So grab a drink. It's a big bit of a long one. Enjoy the conversation, and I'll see you again on the other side.
Good morning. Good morning to everybody watching us on this cloudy day here in Tokyo. And I believe it's cloudy in Japan. Hopefully it's sunny where you are if you're not in the country. And it's a pleasure to welcome you today here and our very first, well, let's say, guest for the first time, Ziv Nakajima Magen. So I hope that I pronounced your name correctly.
Yes, yeah, that was perfect. It's pretty sunny in Fukuoka, by the way. No clouds here.
Oh, really? That's wonderful, yeah. Because Tokyo is under a thick layer of clouds, and it's okay. Kind of raining. But that's what it is. We are in the rainy season, so we cannot help it. And today we're going to talk about real estate in Japan with Ziv, because he has been working in the area for quite a while. He's based in Japan, as you already know, and I believe that many of you already have met him. If not in person, maybe on social media, particularly on LinkedIn. And if you have any questions and any comments, just share them in the comment section, and I'll read them to Ziv when it is appropriate. And I don't want to keep you waiting anymore. So Ziv, again, you have been here for a while, and when I say here, I mean Japan. So could you please tell us a little bit about yourself? And of course, from there, we can dive into the topic, today's topic about real estate in Japan.
Sure. Thank you for having me, firstly. I'm a big fan of the podcast, so it's kind of exciting to be on it. I was born and bred in Israel. Mm-hmm. Kind of left as soon as I could. For various reasons, it's not always the best place to live. And I moved to Australia, where I stayed for about 10 years. Managed to get my passport, my Australian passport as well. Mm-hmm. And then I sort of married into Japan, like many of us, I suppose, and started coming and going to Japan on a regular basis to visit my wife's family. And then eventually, 10 years later, moved here. That was 14 years ago now.
All right, so that's a long journey, if I can say, and you have been in three different countries. You have lived in three different countries, which is already quite an experience. But then here in Japan, you have been here for 14 years, permanently, right, without interruptions and so on. So, and you have been working, I believe, for most of that time in the real estate industry. So what actually pushed you into this direction? Because it's not an easy place to be. I believe that there are quite a few nuances and also characteristics of the industry here in Japan that are quite difficult for foreign professionals.
It's definitely different, yeah. Different, sometimes counterintuitive. I guess, my partner Chikako and I have purchased a few properties for our own investment portfolio and then a property to live in. And just going through the motions, this was again 14, 15 years ago. We were still living in Australia at the time. We kind of figured out that a lot of people could maybe use help with that. So Japan's a very attractive investment market, not necessarily for the same reasons it's attractive in other countries. So again, counterintuitive, but it is an attractive market for people who recognize the advantages of it. But it's very inaccessible. It's getting a little bit better these days, and you know, super hot spots, international aware places like central Tokyo, Niseko, are a bit different in that regard, but vast majority of the country is unfortunately still inaccessible to people who don't live, read, write the language, the Japanese language. So we kind of figured out people could use some help with that, and that's how we got into it.
Right. So is this only the language? Because yes, if you haven't lived in Japan and if you don't speak the language, it's really difficult with all the regulations, of course. And there is a lot of paperwork involved in deals and everything. And so you do need to know your way around all these regulations and so on. And everything is in Japanese. We just I have never seen any forms in English. And it's not only in the real estate, but in almost everything else. But
it's the national support paperwork here, isn't it? Yeah.
It is indeed. But of course, Japanese is the only national language here. So it's not surprising, by the way, because when I think about my country back in Europe, Bulgaria, we don't have forms in English or any other language either. Most of the things are, and I think that 99.9% of everything is in Bulgarian. So
that's true, but I think one of the differences here is that, and that's something that translates into a lot of nuances. But if I, as a foreigner, go to any other foreign country, whether it's a European country, definitely the Western world, and most of Asia, there's going to be a swarm of professionals who will want to take my money and work with me, right? So, and they will find a way to make things happen in English for me and provide translation, interpretation. So it kind of becomes the investor's job to find the ones that are reliable and honest and that we want to work with, right? Mm-hmm. And here it's 180 degrees different. It's exactly the other way around. Everyone is kind of honest and by the book. It's very hard to get swindled in Japan, but finding somebody who agrees to work with a foreigner or will take the extra steps to make it smooth for the foreigner to work with them is very difficult to find. So it becomes a case of not finding who I can trust, but who will agree to work with me.
Right. And that's a difference that many people don't see when they are out of the country, right? Or they don't have any experience here.
And they come in. I know that I've done the same thing. You, as an investor, especially a cash buyer, because, you know, for non-residents, it's still quite challenging to get loans. So most of the buyers are cash buyers if they don't live here. So the assumption is, again, based on other countries, is that I'm coming in with my cash and I'm a buyer and I'm serious and everybody wants to work with me and I can dictate my way. So I can be a bit more pushy. The agents must be very hungry for the deal, and they, you know, they'll flip over backwards to make it happen. It's not like that at all here.
Yeah, it just makes me think about one thing, because in Japan, okyakusama wa kamisama desu. So we know this. And at the same time, there are other barriers, basically, a lot of barriers that do not work in the case of real estate, right? Because, the customer is God, but not really in this industry. So they could be...
The customer is God, but it needs to be a customer that I can serve. And it needs to be a customer that I can serve smoothly the way that I'm used to. And as soon as a foreigner face shows up, especially if they're not here in Japan, then the expectation is that everything will be more complicated and there will be misunderstandings, and that might lead to conflict. And as we know living here, but many people maybe don't know, conflict is a very scary word for Japanese. So
yeah,
it's a little bit different when okyakusama, yes, kamisama, kedo. It's very different when that kamisama is a gaikokuji.
Yes, indeed. And what are some other differences then? Because you mentioned that it is different. The market here is different. The industry is different. And one of these things is that, you cannot just come here with a lot of cash and expect that everything will be fine, right? This is one thing. So what are some other differences that you have noticed throughout your work here in Japan?
Wow, how long do we have? Okay, so the basic stuff is related to what we've already spoken about. So relate the kind of things that come up in all kind of business contexts, relationships, the miscommunications and the mistakes and the things that might be offensive to a Japanese counterpart, and the things that Japanese counterparts do and say that might be offensive to me as a foreigner. So all of the things that we're used to from other areas of doing business in Japan. And the rest of them are more industry related. So for example, definitely in most Western countries, which is where most of our buyers come from, or westernized Asian countries like Singapore or Hong Kong, it's kind of default that you always raise the rent when a lease expires, right? Just as a basic example, rent keeps going up, at least in most major cities. And that hasn't really been the case in Japan to any significant degree. Again, super central, super international hotspots do experience some slight rent hikes, but nowhere near the property price hikes. So the paradigm that foreign buyers have in mind is that, you know, whenever the lease expires, I can choose if I want to renew it or not, and I can choose what the new rent will be. That doesn't really apply here. For one thing, the legislation is very tenant oriented, so you can't just tell a tenant that you're not going to renew the lease. You have to have a very good reason to do that, and in most cases you'll need to offer some compensation because they do have a legal leg to stand on. Not that your typical Japanese tenant will take you to court, most of them will just pack up and move, but if one of them, let's say you've got a very bored old man with a lot of time on their hands, then if they do decide to take you to court, they would have a legal leg to stand on. So we need to notify them well in advance of contract lease expiry, and we need to make sure that we're offering them, number one, because it's the right thing to do, but also legally, we need to offer them compensation if we're asking them not to renew the lease. Mm-hmm. And if we just raise the rent and we don't have a very good reason to do that, aside from the fact that, again, legally, it might be the right to complain about that and cause a fuss because it's not really legally acceptable, the other thing is that they can get a cheaper apartment that's very similar to the one they're living in, which has not raised the rent in many years, and they'll just move out. So I know that I've made that mistake coming in all guns blazing, and I was sure that I knew what I was doing because I had property investments in Australia and bought an apartment, and, oh, the lease is just to expire. Great, let's raise the rent. And the property manager, again, being Japanese, is very conflict averse. So aside from asking, are you sure that you want to do that? They didn't really say much. They didn't want confrontation with the landlord. So they did what I asked for, and the tenant promptly moved out. And then it took us about a year to find a new tenant because that was a whole different reason for that. But the assumptions that we make coming in, that things work here the way that they work in our country of origin. Again, I can go on and on for hours, but things are different here.
Yen Loans are a sponsor of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. They're a non-bank lender offering financing to both residents and non-residents of Japan for purchases of condominiums, as well as equity release cash out financing against properties that you already own in Japan, whether mortgaged or fully paid off. They cover all of Japan's major metro areas, Greater Tokyo, Osaka, Kyoto, Kobe, Nagoya, Fukuoka, and Sapporo, offering a full nationwide footprint for all of your condo purchase financing needs. No residency, incorporation, or Japanese bank account is required, and the application process is highly streamlined. They have legitimate backers, highly reputable, and I can personally vouch for their founder, Mark Drapkin. Yen Loans welcome your business. Reach out to them at yenloans.com and let them know that you heard about them on the Japan Real Estate Podcast to receive 50,000 yen off your loan application fee.
Yeah, I'm now basically in the process of changing office, my office location. And to what you just said, the company, the management, the manager, is that what you call that? The company that manages.
The property manager, yep.
Property manager, they basically gave us an announcement, or they warned us about this 6 months in advance. And they also offered another location, which is actually much better, not only for the same rental fee per month. Well, it's better for the same rental fee, but the first month of being in the new location is basically not charged. So it is given to us free of charge. So and I was like, wow, this is such a good deal, you know. Why wouldn't I continue the rent of the contract, right? So,
yeah.
And it wouldn't happen basically back home. And the only
in
place
most countries, it wouldn't be the case, yeah.
Right, yeah. So I think that this is something which really deserves attention here in the good sense of the word. Is what I mean.
As a tenant, as a landlord, it can be pretty annoying sometimes.
Sometimes, yes. But as a tenant, because we can definitely say that the tenants are more than the landlords. So
the legislation here is tenant-oriented because the Japanese tend to be conflict-averse. So in the past, before it was reformed, landlords were taking huge advantages of tenants. So they would, you know how it's still a thing in many cities in Japan, you pay a thank you fee when you move into an apartment, which is basically just a gift to the landlord for accepting you as a tenant, which is not refundable. And what landlords used to do is they used to charge that fee and a bunch of other kind of exuberant fees to tenants, then kick them out 6 months later and go through the whole motions again with it. Because landlords, by definition, are a little bit more, you know, financially savvy and a bit more business oriented than somebody who's just renting a place to live. And they did used to take advantage of tenants. That's why the legislation was put in place.
Yeah, I see. Which is a good thing.
Yes, definitely.
Right. Well, and then, okay, so you mentioned also advantages, right? So of investing or being in this industry here in Japan. And you also said that probably, well, the advantages are different from the ones in other parts of the world. Can you elaborate on this?
Sure. Well, again, it's a bit counterintuitive, but you know, the paradigm in most countries around the world is that real estate always goes up in value, right? I would argue that it's not necessarily the case, at least in the last couple of decades. But generally speaking, people assume, for example, Australia, where I've lived and worked for many years and had a couple of real estate investments there, Australia is kind of assuming that every 7 years property price will, if not double, very significantly go up. And it has been the case, barring some crisis times like the global financial crisis and COVID. But generally speaking, the assumption is that real estate values will go up. In Japan, this is not the case. So that can be a disadvantage if you're banking on speculative investment in the sense that I'll buy a property and then I'll sell it for double the price. But it's a huge advantage because the fact that vast majority of the country property prices have not gone up means that you can find these extra cheap condo units and houses out in the countryside. So one advantage is affordability. For the price of a single property in many Western markets, you can buy five or six properties here, right? We have clients buying investment mansion condo units in many big cities around Japan. Let's say central Fukuoka, Tokyo, Osaka, Kyoto, those places we put aside. But even the suburbs of Osaka and Fukuoka, or the suburbs of not even suburbs, semi-suburban Sapporo, for example, Nagoya, you can still buy condo units that are good, legit investment properties for as low as 5-6 million yen. Which is unthinkable in other countries. So for your non-resident, for somebody who's not versed in the exchange rate, that's about $30,000 at the moment, right? So there are very cheap deals to be had here. Same story, the Akiya boom that the international media keeps harping on about, people buying properties for, you know, a few thousand dollars or sometimes semi-free in the Japanese countryside to make a holiday home or Airbnb or whatever the case may be. That wouldn't have been possible if property kept going up in value all over the country like it does in many other countries. So that's one advantage. The other one, and again, we've touched on that, is the docile nature of the tenants, right? In other countries, you have to deal with tenants who are constantly complaining, breaking things, and expecting you to repair it. If you go to some neighborhoods in the USA and some other countries, you've got squatters and drug labs, and if you want to evict a tenant who hasn't been paying the rent, you have to apply to court because they'll never move out. Those kind of things don't happen here, right? The tenants are very docile. At any sign of confrontation, they're going to just shy away and move out. They would never, for example, when we started, that was back in 2011, 2012, when we started, it was just on the back of 15 years of deflation in Japan, or 20 years of deflation,
Maybe
past
20.
the 1990s bubble burst. Average rents were about half of what they were back in those days. But I've got tenants who have been living in the same property for 10, 20 years because Japanese like their stability. They don't want to move, even though the rent is half. If they were to move out and then rent a similar apartment anywhere else, or even try to rent the same apartment for me again, I would have to lower the rent by about half. But they would never think to approach the landlord and try to negotiate a lower rent because that's perceived as conflict. Right? So the tenants are very docile, which is a huge advantage. You don't have to deal with tenant issues. You have other issues here. You have elderly population tenants, sometimes destitute tenants who don't have a family or relative, sometimes die in the property. If you've got an elderly gentleman who smokes like a chimney and never opens a window, hikikomori. So we have other types of issues here, but not the tenant problems that we have in other countries. Generally speaking, Japanese tenants are very docile. And the same applies for the properties that for the professionals that you're working with, right? So your property managers, your Japanese real estate agents, there are bad apples everywhere, but the percentage of bad apples here is very, very small. The paperwork culture that we've mentioned is another advantage. Everything has got a paper trail to the moon and back. There's no shady deals under the table, pay half in cash without being everything is documented, everything has legal recourse. It's a very orderly country to be operating in. And the cash flow is decent for a developed country. You know, we can get up to 5-6% return on our investments every year. That's not bad for real estate properties in a developed country.
Indeed, and with very little, as you say, very little conflict. While listening to you, I was thinking that, yeah, sometimes you've got the bad apples, but it's not like the human, what's that, the human relation conflict, right? It's more about, let's say, physical property issues that can be repaired once the tenant moves out. And I think that I have a very limited experience, in just moving from place to place in Japan. Like we have moved maybe 3 or 4 times only. But every time, basically, they repair the apartment or the property before the next tenant comes in. And I think that it's a common practice here. So basically, every time you move into a place, it's pristine, it's clean, it's renovated, right? So
Yes, that's what the tenants expect. So, because all of the apartments would be in prime con or at least cosmetically in prime condition, there might be underlying features that the tenant doesn't know or doesn't care about, but the wallpaper will be fresh, the water fixtures, the electric fixtures will be fresh, the lighting will be nice. It will be very livable from day one, which is what the tenants would expect and what we have to do as landlords between tenants as well. Yeah.
right. And so we all have assumptions. You also mentioned that assumptions are made, and most of the time they're made based on our own experiences out of Japan, of course, or even within Japan. But what are some of the assumptions, or let's say even misconceptions, that people have about investing in real estate here in Japan, or buying property, or in any event, just trying to get some return on investment here.
Well, aside from what we've mentioned regarding how tenancy laws work and the fact that property should be gaining in value, other things in other countries, especially again in the Western world, it's assumed that single-family homes would be the investment class of choice. So you buy a single family home, 3 or 4 bedrooms, you have a family moving there, and that tends to be, those are the cash cows in other countries. That's where you find the tenants easiest, where your management would be easiest. Here I would say that a single family home is a good investment if you want to be very hands-on and if you know how to buy them right. But in most cases, for somebody who's looking for a, let's call it a turnkey semi-passive investment, I would not recommend single family homes for a bunch of reasons. Firstly, they're not built to last in Japan, right? They're built for pretty light wood, plaster, very flimsy materials. And there's various reasons for that, earthquakes being one of them, and the assumption that, you know, Japanese like everything new. So the assumption is that every 30, 40 years you tear the place down and build a new house anyway. But whatever the reason, if you buy a single family home that you haven't done the proper due diligence on and you're not aware of what you're buying, you could potentially, and you buy without a structural inspection, which some people do, you could be buying into some major expenses, sometimes to the tune of the price of the property again, right? Some of the people that we work with in the industry like to say, and I agree with that, is that if you can't afford to buy the property twice, don't buy it in the first place, because it is very possible that you're paying for a cheap single family home that's a little bit older and what you think is a nice location, it comes with headaches that you're not aware of, right? Quality wise. The other thing is that Japan's population trend being what it is, it's a lot more challenging to find a family, meaning some, you know, a couple with more than a single child who will want to rent something of that size, right? Your typical tenant in Japan, because of Japan's shrinking and aging population and the fact that they're not having that many children, our typical tenants are usually singles or maybe a couple, at best a couple with a single child. A family tenant is rare and difficult to find, and most people, when they reach the state where they have a couple of children and they're going to get a mortgage and buy their own place, because Japan's interest rates, I mean, they've been going up recently, but they're still very, very low. So it's actually a lot harder to populate a family-sized property, right? There's other advantages. Families stay in place longer than singles and young couples, but placing them will take a while, and renovation in between tenants will be more expensive because you get a larger floor space. And so the default, let's buy a single family home and rent it out to a family, can apply here if you're the hands-on type who's into a project and you're going to DIY the place and you've got something creative that you might want to do with it, or you might want to run a short-term stay property. But the typical buy a house, buy a single family home, put a family in there and forget about it is not really the default here.
Mm.
Condo units are a lot easier for that purpose, actually.
You mean that it's easier to, or better, maybe better to invest in condo units, or
It's not a matter of better, because every investor is different. We do have a lot of clients who do want the hands-on experience that comes with a single family home. And we do have a lot of clients who, if their budget allows it, we would advise them to buy a part of a small building with two or three floors, multi-units, that you can have diverse income streams, and you've got a larger land plot under your name, which does stand to gain in value more than the structure. And they are pretty cheap in Japan. And a part of building in a good location, good profile, can start as low as 50 million yen, which is about 300,000 US at the moment. So some people go for that. Other people want to do more creative stuff with the property. So for them, maybe owning the entire structure does make sense, because in a condo situation with the owner union strata, you can't really do what you want with the unit. You have to follow the owner union rule book. You have to ask for permission for a lot of stuff. So I'm not saying it's a better investment for everyone. I'm just saying be aware of the differences between what the market is like here and in other countries. And if you're the type who's looking for a hands-off, semi-passive income, kind of salary money in the bank every month investment, then I would say a condo unit is better. Yeah.
Right.
Easier, anyway, easier.
Easier, I see. Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, of course, there are a lot of specifics here in the market, and it's always wonderful to learn. But is there anything else that you would recommend, or maybe talk about some applicable strategies of choosing what to invest in and where to buy property and so on?
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which, if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know. They're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own. But longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home, with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku, or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today. See how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now, back to the podcast.
Sure. Well, when we say invest, I'm assuming you mean people who want to invest for financial gain. You're not talking about somebody buying a house to stay in for their own personal purposes, yeah?
Right. No, okay. I mean, investing, really.
Investing. Yeah. Okay. No, because we have a lot of people telling us we want to invest in Japan. Then we have the conversation, and what they're really looking for is a holiday home. So the first thing we say, hey, that's not really an investment.
Okay.
Because again, the concept overseas is that, you know, I'm buying a property, it's going to gain in value. So even my own personal family home or holiday home is an investment, not necessarily the case here. So to invest strictly for a financial gain, I would advise, if it is a single family home, or if you own the entire structure, let's say an aparto, and it's a wooden or steel framed wood structure, not a concrete structure, which could be the case with houses and most small apartment buildings, I would aim for 20 years and younger, because when you buy, once they hit about 30 years of age, in the case of steel framed wood, maybe 35, is when maintenance expenses start accruing and renovations need to be done a bit more rapidly. And that's when your yield starts to shrink. And as a result, the resale value will start to shrink more rapidly as well, because the people buying these properties for you in most cases are going to be investors as well, and they think about the yield same as you do. So if they know that the expenses are piling up, they would expect a lower price to compensate for that, right? So I would normally buy, if it's a wooden or steel framed wood structure, I would normally buy them as close as I can get to 20 years and younger, maybe 25 if I can swing a 20, and then start consider reselling it as they approach 30.
Right. But is this one of the, right, yeah, but is this one of the things that the property listings don't tell you? Because
they tell you how old the property is. Yeah,
they do. Okay, yeah. So then what are some of the things that those listings don't tell you then?
Well, if it's a entire structure on a land plot that you own entirely, so not a condo unit, if it's a house or an aparto, they might not always specify in the listings if it's rebuildable or not, right? So zoning regulations tend to get stricter over time. These days, you need a certain width of access road for emergency vehicles, certain distance from the neighbors. You can only build up to a certain height. Those restrictions, depending on the agent, sometimes they're listed on the listing, sometimes they're not. So you could find out if you haven't asked the question or you haven't reviewed it. It'll always be in the official documentation, but if you haven't reviewed it properly or you haven't understood what it means, you could end up in a situation where you bought a property, earthquake or big typhoon hits, it's a complete total loss because, again, flimsy wooden structures, and then you find out that you've got insurance compensation, but you have to take that money and go buy another land plot because you can't build a new structure on the same land plot anymore, right? The realtors, it's also important to understand that the agents, the realtors' role here in Japan is not to educate you. They're not here to tell you what questions to ask. Right. They will divulge all information completely honestly and professionally if you ask them, and they will provide all documentation for you to review. But if you don't know what to pay attention to and you don't know what questions to ask, getting angry at the agent is pointless. It's not their job to teach you everything about the market or tell you what, or raise red flags. Their job is to help you purchase the property that you want to purchase legally and smoothly. They can help you research properties if you give them criteria, but they're not going to help you prioritize one property over another, raise red flags. Some of the more internationally savvy ones will try to do that to a certain degree. They're still Japanese and they still avoid conflict, so they're not going to be aggressively pointing out stuff, but basically it's not their job. So if you don't know what questions to ask, then you wouldn't know that maintenance expenses start piling up for wooden structures at 30, for concrete structures at 40. Those things, that's kind of like what we are there for. If you don't have the experience or the know-how, then aside from the fact that we bridge the cultural and language gap, we also provide you with the expertise, and we're not shy to tell people if we think they're making a bad purchase. Some of them get angry because we tell them that too much, but we're not shy to say it.
Right. And what you mentioned, that it's not their job to educate you. And I have noticed that also with accounting firms here. So, I mean, as a company owner, they're there to basically help you do your taxes legally and everything smoothly and everything, which is wonderful. But if you want to ask them advice of, you know, how to basically reduce this or maybe increase that, or improve your balance sheet, they actually don't do that if you don't ask them the right questions. Again, I think that it basically goes for most of let's say the industries here and services as well. So they're not consultants, right?
One of the Yeah, that's one of the gripes that many people, and I to some extent have about Japan, isn't it? Is that they're very good at following procedure, but creativeness, inventiveness, not innovation, not a huge thing here. That's a whole different topic that's not related to real estate. We can talk about the education system and again, conflict aversion and the nail that sticks out, but that's something that's not expected of a professional in Japan. There are some rare financial advisors that cost a lot of money or multinational accounting firms that are aware of all the tips and tricks in other countries and then come and apply them here in Japan. But it's not your default accountant that's going to be filing your taxes every month. No.
And it applies obviously to in the real estate industry as well. Like,
Definitely. Yeah.
yeah, there as well. Yeah, which is indeed interesting. And we can also just say that it's something based on the cultural specifics here of the whole market as well, and the way the country thinks and the nation thinks and so on. But okay, so let me move on. Also, I went through the newsletter that you publish on LinkedIn, and I have to say that to everybody who is listening or watching now, if you haven't subscribed to Gilles Bazouf's newsletter, just go there and give it a read and decide whether to describe to subscribe or not. But I immediately subscribed, you know, when I read it,
Oh, thank
because
you.
there is a lot of very useful information there. And in one of the publications there, Aziv, you say that location in Japan is not the same as location elsewhere. And then what is the difference? What is behind the word location and the term location here? Is it once again the assumptions we make that they're different, or I don't know. Just
It's
please.
more a case of being aware of the nuances of the market here, which is very different, a little bit more nuanced. So location is always a good rule in real estate, and Japan is no different. You want to buy a property in the right place. The point is, what does that right place mean, right? So, again, somebody coming from a country like the USA, for example, where everybody has a car and drives everywhere, are not aware that here public transport is so heavily ingrained into society that a lot of people who are not even interested in real estate here still know the automatic rule: when you buy a property, it has to be within 10 minutes walk to a station, right?
Yeah, indeed.
That's something that somebody coming from another country is assuming. Oh, if I got a property that has a park, parking availability next to the property, it might be good. But vast majority of your tenants don't own a car, so they don't care that there's parking available. If it's family, again, different story. But most of your single young couples, entry-level professional salaryman, definitely low-income shift workers, they don't have a car, probably will never have a car, so that distance to station becomes huge, right? And similarly, people assume that if they buy a property in a big city in Japan, that it's probably okay. But no, not all cities are created equal. Not all suburbs within the city are equal. That will dictate your tenant base. That will dictate the, proximity to a university. In many countries, student housing is a great industry to get into. Here, it's another strategy, not necessarily as attractive as it is in other countries. So again, the nuances of every market, every city are different. Japan is very fragmented in that sense. And even within a big city, even within Tokyo, I mean, Tokyo officially is not a city, it's a bunch of little cities. But even within Tokyo, every location is very different. The fact that you have a property within the greater Tokyo area doesn't necessarily make it a good investment.
Right, I see. I remember when we lived in Sapporo, and the winters there are long and snowy. And so basically, we lived relatively close to the center, but the building, the apartment building, was old. And even though it had a parking lot for all the apartments there, basically, it was quite inconvenient because it didn't have the road heating. And once it started snowing, I had to shovel the snow 3 times a day. Because if I didn't do that, yeah, I wouldn't be able to get the car out. It snowed so much. almost every day. And while, you know, the properties, the newer properties, the newer buildings around there, they had that road heating system, and basically they never had to shovel. So, and basically every day for me, I spent 3 hours of my day doing that, right? Which is a huge
Oh,
amount of time.
it is yourself
And
as a
the,
tenant who has a car. But Sapporo is probably worth a note on its own accord. It's one of Japan's biggest cities, and it's a great place to invest in. But the fact that the winters are so long and harsh in Hokkaido means that you have to factor that into your yield calculations, right? So if you happen to get a vacancy in the winter, it's very likely that it's going to be a 4 or 5, 6 months vacancy because nobody likes to move when it snows that hard. You've got maintenance equipment, heating equipment that constantly breaks down and is very expensive to replace, which is not the case in warmer climates. So when we evaluate a deal in Sapporo, we like to aim for a slightly higher yield than we do in other cities because we know that it's going to even out over time due to the nature of that. Similar, by the way, in Nagoya for different reason, or some other cities like Kitakyushu, population is very blue collar, right? So it's still Japan. You're not going to have ghettos and crime labs and drug labs and so forth, but you do occasionally have somebody who can't pay the rent and has to move out mid-lease, or you have to reach an arrangement with them to pay a little bit extra every month because they haven't paid for 2, 3 months. So there are more issues there that make us aim for a higher yield. So location also comes with the nature of the city. Population decline, that's something that you have to look at when you're aiming for I mean, there are a lot of attractive second tier, third tier cities in Japan where you could potentially get higher yield than a big city, but you have to carefully watch the population trends, right? Japan being Japan, a lot of the smaller townships are shrinking as people are conglomerating to the bigger metropolitan centers. You have to aim for a location that doesn't have a single employer or single factory or single industry that might move to another location and completely dry out your tenant base. So again, the nuances of every city and locations within the city are important for holiday homes as well. Even if it's not an investment, if you're buying somewhere that's beautiful and scenic and the house look great, but the bus only runs twice a day, there's not a single English speaker in town. When you need basic stuff like your how far is the sometimes they don't even have a convenience store, how far is the supermarket? Does anybody speak English at the hospital? How far is the hospital? Those are all things that you probably need to think about. The nuances are plenty.
I just a thought now, because you mentioned that if you are an English speaker or a foreign language speaker, you need somebody in that location, for example, to at least one person to speak the language you do to help you in times of need. So do you see in the near future, let's say, hubs of foreigners appearing in Japan, like people who have decided to invest in certain rural areas, and those areas develop as foreign hubs, you know, for people coming from overseas to live there, and like predominantly foreign communities. Do you see this happening?
To be current, I would say that that has been an increasing trend. But our beloved current Prime Minister Takaichi-san seems hell-bent on reversing that trend. So that's a lot of people are now sitting on their hands thinking whether they should be buying in Japan or not, because we're obviously a little bit less welcome here now than we were up until last October, November. So generally speaking, yes, that does happen when there's a steady welcoming influx of foreigners into the country. And governments in other places like Australia take advantage of that, right? You get an easier visa, and you get some financial bonuses for settling in if you go to these places where they want you to rejuvenate the rural areas that are dying out. So if and when Japan behaves in that way, and again, it's very fragmented. So even when there was a national initiative that said that, hey, we want to help get rid of these abandoned homes, for example, the Akiyas in the countryside, they're rotting away, they're eyesore, they're unsafe, they're depressing the economy, you want to get rid of them. So, you know, the national government declared a Akiya Bank initiative, and they told every municipality that, okay, you now have to set up an Akiya Bank, a repository where you'll be collecting information about all of these abandoned properties in the countryside and do your best to try and sell them and, you know, promote your house supplies and attractive things for people to move into your municipality and restore and renovate these houses or build new houses in their stead. But Japan being Japan, there's always a huge gap between the national policy and how it's going to be implemented. Right. Nobody forces those local municipalities to do that. So some of them signed up for the task and you know, made an initiative of it and did a good job. And that did attract not just foreigners, but sometimes hubs of domestic people who are interested in that area for whatever reason. And COVID was a good way for them to capitalize on that, for example, when people wanted to move out of the city for a while. But in other locations, it's a case of, we have to set up an Akiya bank. Or, Watanabe-san, you're in charge of that. Gambatte. And that's it. And nobody right. and nobody does anything beyond that, right? Or there's a single board agent that they relegate the job to, some realtor who works that area, who's not really that interested in it, not making much money on these properties. And then the initiative just dies away. And some places make it very difficult for foreigners to form that hub, right? There are very insular communities in Japan that seem to be a lot more leaning towards just dying out and fading away than allow scary foreigners to take over the city, right? So it's very fragmented. Sometimes it happens when the environment allows it. Sometimes it doesn't.
Right. Even though I do believe that, I mean, from talks I have listened to and being, you know, part of, it looks to me like they just are trying to, what's that, to regulate all the influx of foreigners rather than chase away the ones who are here and who are not doing anything illegal. But
I've been pushing back on that.
Now, if you're actively looking at property in Japan, you should check out Akiya Mart. That's AKIYA-Mart, MART, akiyamart.com. It's the Zillow of Japan, built for buyers who are actively hunting for a home in Japan and want a much more Western-style web browsing experience than the typical local Japanese websites. Now, we've got an exclusive 30% off promo code for the Akiya Mart Pro annual plan. That's the one that gives you full access to Airbnb zoning maps, hazard maps, sold data, and over 500,000 listings nationwide at any given time. So if you're serious about buying in Japan and you want an easier way to search, this is the best tool that we know of. So you can use my code ZIV, Z-I-V, at checkout and get 30% off your Akiya Mart Pro annual plan at akiyamart.com.
Back on that. I'd be pushing back on that. I see a lot of small businessmen who have been doing very, men and women, who have been doing very hard work and doing beautiful things, whether it's for rural rejuvenation, whether it's for cultural stuff, basic stuff, like we've been reading in the news in the last couple of weeks, like people who've been running Indian or Nepali restaurants here for 15, 20 years and suddenly have to go back home because what's the 30 million capital requirement? 90%, 80, 90% of Japanese businesses don't have that. So to ask a small, struggling foreign business owner to suddenly come up with that, we're losing some good people here. People who were rejuvenating the countryside and you know, creating hospitality properties, farm stays, artist retreats, drawing people not only from Japan, but from all over the world to come and witness the beauty of these rural areas. They're all drying up and going home. They're not allowed to stay anymore. So I don't agree with that at all, actually.
Okay, because I also think that, I mean, we don't have to argue about this. Just I'm trying, you know, to clarify it even for myself. That
the purpose, I understand the purpose, but it's a lazy blanket statement. That's not the way
right,
to do it.
Yeah. But also, do you think it's because I think that they are basically talking about visa, what's that, business visas, right? It's not about permanent residence. And of course, once again, it's I'm not saying that it is good that they are trying to push out people on business visas, because as you say, some of those people are really working very hard and they have been contributing to the local economies, local communities and everything. But I just think that it's, we need to make also that distinction, not to justify what, you know, the what is happening to the visa business visa holders, but still the permanent residents are not covered by that change in regulation. at least at this point of time.
Yes, but they're talking about implementing other changes in reform. Mm-hmm. For example, it used to be the case that if you lived in the country for a certain number of years on a legitimate visa of any other sort, then you could apply for permanent residency. So people had a course laid out in front of them. They knew where they were going. They knew that if I stay here as a company employee, or if I've got my own business, or if I'm married, or whatever the case may be, then within 10 years, I will be able to apply for permanency, right?
Right, yes.
Now they've changed that, right? So now if you haven't held a visa for a that has been granted for a period of 5 years at least. So for example, if you are on a 1 year or 3 year renewable visa, then you're not gonna be able to apply for permanency. And how is that decided, whether you're gonna get 1 year or 3 year or 5 years? Well, the immigration department decides that, but they don't really tell you what the criteria for that decision is.
It's
a very vague black box within the immigration department that even immigration lawyers are not aware of how that decision is made. They make assumptions, but they don't have a clue. So I've got, again, good, hardworking people, a couple very good friends, neighbors of ours, one of them from Italy. The other one is actually Brazilian, but Nikkei, so kind of returning Japanese citizen with Japanese ancestry from Brazil. They've been living here for, I think, 3 or maybe 4 years now. Mm-hmm. Working hard, paying a hell of a lot of taxes, employed by one of them is a freelancer, the other one is employed by an international company. Working very hard, paying a lot of taxes, renting places, putting money in the pocket of landlords, thinking about getting their own home. And suddenly it's a case of, no, we don't know if you're going to get a permanent visa. So they said, okay, well, you know, we're an international couple. If we can plan our life ahead here, then we'll plan it ahead elsewhere, where we do know that we'll be able to stay until we're elderly. And, you know, they're talking about introducing very harsh language requirements for permanent residency, which I kind of agree with. But again, it's not backed up by national programs to help people reach that proficiency level, right? Similar to the business manager visa, if you're Singapore and you're one of the most attractive entrepreneurship hubs in the world, sure, specify a 30 million yen capital, because people constantly want to come. Japan is not exactly that. Entrepreneurs coming here need to struggle with so many things. I mean, just opening a bank account or finding somebody who will let you rent an office in Japan is very much of an uphill battle. So I don't think Japan is quite, and especially with the rapidly aging population decline and the workforce shrinking and the pension funds just about to burst under the burden of more and more and more elderly people to support, I'm not sure Japan is in the position to be quite as selective on its immigration policies, is what I'm saying.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like, I understand both arguments, both sides. But one, the question once again is then how can they reconcile that or bridge those, well, basically the
not
reality.
Not with lazy blanket statements, I would say. I think the proper way to have done it, but it's difficult, it's challenging, it's a lot of work. But I think the proper way to do that is to, you know, I understand that there are a lot of fake businesses here, and I understand that there are a lot of misbehaving foreigners, but the way to do it is not to kill a cockroach with a sledgehammer. The way to do it, and thereby breaking your own house in the process, the way to do it is to lean back and surgically look at those applications. And Japan knows how to review what's a fake business and what's not. They do it on a regular basis. They should have been doing more of that. They know how to review who's living here legally and properly and who's not. It just takes a lot of work to sift through those cases. It's a lot easier to make a blanket statement. And it also gets you a few votes along the way, because the population is getting elderly and more conservative. And it's easy to get elected when you point at the bad foreigners, right?
That's true. And I mean, populism is also, you know, getting stronger here as well. Yeah. So unfortunately.
Sorry, we're not talking about real estate anymore.
That's true, sorry. No, but it's also something that affects every industry in Japan, and I believe it affects your industry as well. So, and also, well, I think that I also read in one of your newsletter publications on LinkedIn that basically in Japan, you've got specific deal model that is something different once again. And I wanted, when I read that, I actually thought, I want to hear more from Ziv. So if you don't mind talking a little bit about this.
Deal model? I'm trying
deal to model, in yes. An example of a deal in Japan, so in the real estate industry. So what is a deal here? Like, what do you do? Do you just shake hands, you know, and and you're done? It's obviously it's not the case, right? So
I'm not sure which article you're referring to, but the way it's done here is in some ways similar, in some ways a little bit different. So for example, when you submit an offer on a property here, in many countries, that offer is a legal document, right? And you're going to be paying a fine if you then back away from the offer.
Right.
Here, that's not the case. So a letter of intent or an offer to purchase is not a legally binding document.
Mm-hmm.
It is a professionally binding document, meaning that once you've submitted the offer, and if you haven't written any specific conditions on it, it's assumed that you will be proceeding with the deal. And if you then, for any reason that's not related to the seller, if you, for your own reasons, then back out of the deal, then that relationship will be completely burned. That agent will never work with you again. If you were working with a buyer's agent, then that listing agent will never work with your buyer's agent again. So you've tarnished their reputation as well. And frankly, you've tarnished the reputation of most foreigners, because if that particular seller has not worked with foreigners in the past, then now they've immediately got in their mind the image of, oh, foreigners are tire kickers. We shouldn't even bother with them anymore, because a Japanese person would not do that, right? Structural inspections are usually a part of any deal when you're buying a structure. In Japan, it's not the norm. We do recommend to our clients that they do that, at least if the property is, let's say, 30 years and younger. But in Japan, that is not the norm. It's not a given, which sometimes surprises people who assume that a structural inspection is a part and parcel of every deal. That's not always the case here. But aside from that, I'm not sure which article you're referring to. Aside from those things, it's fairly similar to the way it works in other countries. So once you've reviewed all the documentation, you've done your due diligence on the property, your offer was accepted or negotiated and then accepted, then you sign the contract, you pay a 10% deposit, the lawyer drafts some ownership transfer documents, which you have signed and witnessed, and then about a month after the contract, the property gets transferred over to you. Negotiations may be worth touching on, because it's very common in other countries to lowball, right? So sellers are listing properties a lot higher than what they should be really worth, because they're hoping that they can get more money for it. And also they're assuming that people will want to, you know, do some hard negotiations with them. Then somebody comes in and offers lowball offer, maybe half the price, maybe 75% of the listed price. That's not really how the market works here. It's, again, not a conflict oriented, and haggling is considered conflict. So it's not really a heavy negotiation oriented market, barring, again, you know, super popular international hotspots like Central Tokyo and Niseko and so forth. But generally speaking, unless the seller is living in La La Land, maybe pre-bubble days, and they think they can get, you know, the couple of million that they paid back then, which is not the case anymore. But in most cases, their agent, the listing agent, will advise them on what's a reasonable market price. They would set it up at maybe 10% over that to allow for, you know, slight negotiation. And if we come in with offers that are more than 10, maybe 15%, if it's a vacant property that's been standing there for a while, but anything beyond that, we're not going to be taken seriously, and it's very likely that we're just going to be ghosted. They're not going to return our emails and calls anymore. So take negotiation easy. It's not really the thing here.
Right. Okay. No, thank you for that. So because you said that there are a lot of things that are different with some similarities to other markets as well. So, and then my next question is, well, basically you are a partner and chief operations officer, I believe, in Nippon Tradings International. So do you do that for your clients in Japan, all these negotiations, negotiations, right, in quotation marks, and also all the necessary, the due diligence and the technical checks and the inspections and everything. So basically, if somebody comes to you and they say, well, I want to invest in Japan, where do you start from telling them? Do you do all the work for them, and then I don't know.
Yeah. So to answer the first part of the question, yes, we can work in one, we or I can work in one of two ways. As a company, we offer full purchase facilitation services. So you give us legal authority to act in Japan on your behalf, and then we will be talking to all of the third parties, we'll be attending all the meetings, we'll be signing all the documents, we'll be receiving your funds from you in bulk and distributing them domestically to where they need to go, because international transfers in Japan are still a thing. Most people that you work with here don't even know their SWIFT code or how to receive, or let alone open a Wise account. So it's getting a little bit easier, but you still need some help with that. And also, you can't open a bank account as a non-resident. So for management as well, if you're not a resident, we can hold your income here, collect your rental income from the property manager, pay your expenses on your behalf, give you a statement once a year, and then when the rates justify or whenever you need your income back home, we remit. So we act as your de facto bank account for only the purpose of that property management operation, right? And manage the property managers, the renovation companies, deal with the building management company, the insurance company, all of these third parties in Japan that might be difficult for a non-resident foreigner to work with directly. So we offer full purchase facilitation and then full management. I personally also do consulting separately. So people who are able to work directly with the third parties involved can hire me to come in and hold their hand. Because again, the realtor, the people that you're working with, are not here to educate you or strategize with you. So I would be joining the conversation as they work directly with the agent, directly with the lawyer, guiding due diligence, telling them what to watch out for, raise red flags, review documents before they sign them, just make sure they're not making any costly mistakes.
Right.
That course is a lot cheaper than us doing everything on your behalf. And to the second part of your question, how it would start is before all of that, we would first have a conversation, especially if it's an investor, but also with holiday home shoppers, just to make sure that you're aware of what you really want to buy and that you're not having any preconceived assumptions that might not be correct here. We want to talk to you about what the rest of your investment portfolio looks like, if you're already invested in anything else, in any other countries, in any other assets. If it is a real estate investment or equity market investment or whatever you have, what's the structure of your portfolio at the moment? Is it more speculative? Is it more cash flow oriented? Mm-hmm. And then we would probably advise on how to complement that with whatever you'll be buying in Japan that should be suitable for your investment needs.
Right. Well, I believe that it's really helpful, because once again, if you haven't tried to do anything here in Japan, you don't know how difficult it is and how important it is to have people who
challenging,
can help you.
Challenging. Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, it's very smooth. Again, you don't need to look over your shoulder and watch out for dodgy stuff happening like you would in some other countries, but it's very procedural, like everything in Japan.
Very much.
Yeah. And nuanced.
Yeah, sometimes I talk with colleagues that work in different colleagues, when I say people who have their own businesses, run their own companies. And it's there is a phenomenon I have noticed, you know, that, and not only me, but them as well, that when foreign investors come to Japan and you help them and you do everything on their behalf and you make it so smooth for them and everything, and then they go home and they say, oh, Japan is so easy to work with.
Yes.
Yeah. And then
we have time. I've been running the Japan real estate podcast for about 9 years now.
Right.
I think it's still probably the only audio source. So we have some, it's very hard. It's easier to interview success cases than the other cases, but we do occasionally have somebody who says, you know, I've listened to your podcast. I've been hearing all these things, and you make it sound so easy. And then I went and tried it on my own because I thought I'm going to save a few bucks if I try it on my own. But it's not that easy, is it? No. We've been doing it for a while. We know what the bridges are that we need to gap for you. But on your own, it's reinventing the wheel. You're learning everything from square one, and it is a different market. Yeah.
It is a different market in, every industry, basically, that you try to penetrate here in Japan. It's really different. But yes, okay, Ziv, so thank you so very much for making time to be on the podcast. I appreciate you sharing all these insights, the knowledge, the know-how, because, of course, it is something that you have earned through experience. through working here for such a long time. And it's something that many people don't have, the majority of people don't have. So thank you very much for doing that. And so to everybody watching us, if you haven't connected with Ziv, please do connect with him on LinkedIn. You can connect and then also watch or listen to his podcast if you're interested in investing here. You are in safe hands with Ziv. So do not hesitate to reach out to him. Yes. And I'm actually very much looking forward to the second episode we're going to have with you, Ziv. So to people interested in this topic, please stay tuned. And the next episode will be announced in the next couple of weeks. So thank you very much indeed. And Ziv, I hope that you have a productive day. And to everybody who has watched us again, enjoy the day. Let's say that the rest of the week will be good for you as well. And I'm looking forward to seeing you all together once again here. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So there you have it. Huge thanks again to Maya and the Japan Expert Insights crew for having me on. Thoroughly enjoyed this conversation as well as our second one. We will link, of course, to their podcast and YouTube channel in this episode show notes, and we'll be publishing the second conversation in a few weeks' time. So watch this space. Subscribe if you haven't yet. Now, we can't let you go without telling you about MailMate, our sponsors and business partners. They offer peace of mind for your property in Japan. They'll make sure that your taxes, your utility bills are all paid on time, liaise with your management company for you, or assist with your parcel delivery while you're out of town. Get in touch with them on mailmate.jp today and mention the Japan Real Estate Podcast for 10% off your first year. And that's it from us for this episode, folks. Huge thank you for tuning in. Please do follow and subscribe to the show if this is your first time listening. And we'd love it if you could like and even share this episode with anyone you think might find interest in it. But even more importantly, we love hearing from you. So please let us know what you thought about this episode or the podcast overall in the comments section here on our social media channels. We've got a very active Facebook group and business page, both under the name Japan Real Estate on Facebook. And that's also the name and URL of our YouTube channel if you'd like to follow us there, Japan Real Estate on YouTube as well. And we'd of course appreciate your rating or review on Spotify or on the Apple Store or wherever you're tuning in from. Hope to have you with us again. Have a great rest of the day or night ahead. よろしく。